Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
You are listening to Troubadours and Raconteurs with E.W. Conundrum Demure on Radio Free Brooklyn. Welcome to episode 276 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we have a conversation with Michael Flynn, founder, artistic director, and executive producer of the Scranton Shakespeare Festival, as well as one of the premier assistant directors on Broadway today. We talked to Mr. Flynn about his journey into theater, about the Scranton Shakespeare Festival, about politics in art, and many other very interesting areas of discourse. A great conversation today with Michael Flynn. We also have an EW essay titled Righteous and Bold, and another great piece by our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, called Gypsy, as well as a poem titled She. And all of this, of course, as is always the case, will be infused and complemented with the music of several wonderful artists. Let's get to it. Episode 276 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. Righteous and bold, the dancing bluebells that somehow mystically have intertwined with a wild maple tree enamors me profoundly, and small, portly birds with dark, black, symmetrical, wide-angled lines atop beige, brown, thin-feathered cheeks, perfectly showing the center with a tiny aquiline beak, speaks pure, natural joy through its peeps and tweets. And I walk across my backyard deck, down the steps, into it all, as these moments help me to recall more innocent times I had as a younger person. And I think and ruminate about these destructive, fearful policies my government has crafted that take children out of the arms of their parents, off the breast as they suckle for nourishment and security, as natural and beautiful and legitimate as all else in this tangible world of humanity. And I wonder, I grapple with questions of why are we doing this? Why is our society allowing this, supporting this? Is it not true that we live in the land of the free and of the brave? Yet, look at how we behave. Not free, but instead closed. Not brave, but instead afraid and cold. I am privileged, and thus will not be told that my stead as a citizen human should support such divisive means of existence. I am feeling righteous and bold.
The vegetable man in the vegetable van with the hornets honking like a mariachi band. In the middle of the street, people gather around. Put the dollar, dollar, dollar in the can. I wait. K on the TJ Cowboys hang around. Sleeping in the sidewalk with a Burger King crown. Never wake them up. Massive insult to the rooster crows. Vatos vergallos. Chevas on cheap guitars, abuelitas with plastic bags, walking to the church with the Spanish candles. Billy Baracho says, que putas, andale joto, your popsicle's melting. Run, little, run, little, do, run, run, in the midnight sun. Replays, Guatemalan soccer ball, it's the replays. Mango ladies, vendedoras at a bus stop, sing a band of macho chorus.
What?
Yeah, bro.
up at Gork. They have the new Yanni cassette.
Hello.
Hello, Michael Flynn. Is that you?
It is indeed me. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, good. Thank you so much for being on Troubadours and Rock on Tours.
I'm flattered and really excited. Thanks for having me.
Oh, a pleasure. And I want to let some of the folks know who don't know already who you are. I have a little bit of a bio, but we're going to build on that in our conversation. Founder, artistic director, and executive producer of the Scranton Shakespeare Festival, as well as one of the premier assistant directors working on Broadway today, working with some major, major powerhouses on Broadway. And
that's true, yeah.
Yeah, it's impressive. And you're a young man on top of it, just getting started.
Yes, yes. I've been very fortunate. I'm really grateful that I've got to work with some of the really cool professionals that I've been able to.
Oh, yeah, we're going to get into that. Douglas Carter Bean and Jack O'Brien. My gosh. Nathan Lane, yeah. But tell us a little bit, how did you end up in theater?
You know, it's like a pretty crazy story because I remember in preschool, I was going to John Marshall Elementary School, and it was one of the first days, and I can still recall there was like a big bin of like these big play school blocks. And I walked over to them, and I was telling all the students, like, let's build a stage, let's build a stage. So I guess, like, innately, I was always really interested in storytelling, and I don't know where that came from. I mean, I had an older sisters who were in dance recitals, and, you know, my parents, you know, would occasionally listen to, like, the cassette of, like, Jesus Christ Superstar on, like, a long road trip. And I would say that I had, like, a fair amount of access to, like, the arts, but it honestly, I think, was something like pretty innate and something that I always just took like a liking to at a young age. But it's one of those sort of inexplicable things, and I don't really remember exactly when it started, but I just knew that I've always had an appetite for it.
And you know, did some of the significant elders in your life try to dissuade you, knowing that it's not easy making a living in theater?
You know, I've been fortunate. I mean, of course, I can recall like being at a high school graduation and, you know, people asking you, what are you going into? And then you let them know that you're pursuing a career in theater, and you could see the look of panic, you know, and flush come across their face. But fortunately, I have to say that my family's been super supportive, and that's been great. And I've also had a really great network of teachers from this area that have been super supportive of me pursuing a career in it. So I've been pretty fortunate on that front. My father basically always said, you know, I think the way he looks at it is if you enjoy what you're doing, you know, that's something that I think he really wants for all of his kids. So they've always, both he and my mother have been always really supportive of, you know, any sort of endeavors I've been a part of, which I'm super grateful for.
Oh yeah.
And there's sort of this like weird, yeah, totally. And there's also this like sort of weird, I think like phony idea that like a career in, and of course like a career in the arts is very hard, but you know, there's a lot of jobs you can get with a theater degree. And I feel like, you know, sometimes people would much rather you have an English literature degree or a philosophy degree, but you know, there are a lot of jobs such as like, you know, doing like lighting shows for car companies and like very, very different professions sort of stem out of something that you could learn from a theater, an understanding of theater and like a collegiate level. So I think that like there's a little bit more employment there than you might lead, and a lot of skills that you could learn there that lead you to have like a number of successful professions later on down the road. But fortunately for me, I didn't get too much resistance from my family.
Well, yeah, when all else fails, you can always just, you know, become a lawyer, right? That's theater.
Oh, yeah, right, right. That is theater, right?
No doubt. So you say this area, and you and I are from the same area, from northeastern Pennsylvania, Scranton more specifically. We have listeners mm-hmm. all over the place. So, you know, we got to put that into context for folks that aren't from this area. And you started here. You went to high school here. You went to college here. And then you made a contact that was pretty significant, who had, I guess, a summer home here while you were trying to make your way in New York City. And that contact really helped you open doors, right? And that contact being...
That's true.
That's Douglas Carter Bean. Tell folks a little bit about that.
Sure. So it would have been the second year of the Scranton Shakespeare Festival, and Douglas Carter Bean does live somewhat close to the Scranton area has a summer home out here. And he was, I think, just sort of investigating the Scranton theater scene, and he had come to a production that we had mounted our second year of The Comedy of Errors by Shakespeare up in Nahant Park. And I think he had a very pleasant experience. And after that, he had invited me to assist him. He was the playwright for a new play that was going to be at Lincoln Center on Broadway. And it was called The Nance. And he wrote it, and it was going to be starring Nathan Lane and Louis Stadlin, Katie Huffman, and some other really great Broadway actors. And that was sort of like the door in. I had worked on that experience. It was really fantastic. You know, just being able to go to Lincoln Center every day to work was pretty exciting. But also then once we transferred to the Lyceum, which is, I think, the oldest theater on the Broadway circuit currently, that was really exciting. But it was in that room, you know, watching those people act, but that I also was able to meet Jack O'Brien. And I think that was sort of the moment, because at that time I was assisting him as a writer, which basically meant when there were rewrites or when people needed new pages or when, you know, the playwright was doing something else and the director needed something, I was sort of serving as a liaison. But it was in that room when I was first introduced to Jack O'Brien, and that's when I was like, wow, I want to be a director, just because of his amazing ability to hold a room. It was pretty captivating. It was really a sight to behold. So, yeah, Doug was able to provide me with that opportunity, and he also has been really wonderful because he has premiered two of his two new works with our company, the Scranton Shakespeare Festival. The first being Fairy Cakes, which is sort of like a fractured fairy tale story. It's all done in rhyming couplets. And it's like all the different fairies from the Shakespeare play Midsummer Night's Dream. But what he does with it is he actually has those fairies taking the roles of some of these fairies in classic fairy tales. So one of them is Pinocchio's fairy. One of them is Tinkerbell, even though, you know, I don't think he says Tinkerbell, but all of these like classic fairy tales. And because of those, there's sort of like hijinks ensue. So it was a really interesting piece. And then the second show he did with us was called Robin Hood, and it was a musical, and Lewis Flynn was a part of that as well, and Joey Peasy, who's a choreographer on all of like the big movie musicals, came out and choreographed that here. And that was a really stunning, exciting, like full-scale Broadway show. And we had an amazing Broadway costume designer, Gregory Gale, come out and design it. It was really a spectacular production. And we had that right here for free to our community, which was pretty exciting.
Oh, it is. I understand that you've gotten some support financially from the National Endowment for the Arts in the past. I don't know if that's...
Yes. We've been fortunate to get it for the second year in a row. So I believe you can only get it 3 years in a row, this specific grant. But we're really grateful for it because, you know, being free of the public, we really rely on these grants as well as, like, individual donations so that we can pay... You know, our actors are very meager living stipend, but also not put actors in front of a bare stage, you know, so that we can have costumes and props. So we've been really fortunate to get the sponsorship of the National Endowment of the Arts.
And this is your sixth or seventh year?
This is our seventh. We're about to embark on our seventh summer of programming.
Right. And why Shakespeare? Why Shakespeare, the context in which you have this festival? Because of name recognition? Or do you find his works, like so many people do, just so compelling and timeless?
They are very... it's a little bit of all of the above. It started off, I was doing a Shakespearean production of Hamlet in Binghamton. And we were doing it mostly for schools, but we received quite a lot of snow. So it was sort of like a lot of time reflecting during a snowstorm for a production that we weren't even able to perform as much as we would have liked. And it was at that time that I really had this, this strong feeling to do a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream in Naog Park. I just really wanted to make that happen. And this director who I was working with had worked at the Royal Shakespeare Company. Her name is Rosemary Hay. And she had done a production with her theater company called Rev Theater Company. And she had said, you know, we've already done this. We'd love to do it. And, you know, we were able to round up some local actors, as well as some actors from Philadelphia, a few actors from New York. And we mounted this production in about 3 weeks. And we were hoping for, like, 100 people to show up. And to our surprise, there were somewhere between, like, 800 and 1,000 people there for those two performances.
Wow, and that's the first year.
And even though we had a very... That's the first year. And, you know, even though it was a very small budget, we were able to make enough money that we were able to become a 501c3 organization, which was a pretty big step for us. And then the year after that, we did another Shakespearean comedy, and we did added a few extra performances, and we had downpour rain, and people who stayed, you know, there were people in wheelchairs popping up their umbrellas, who were waiting for us to continue. So we did, which was a pretty gratifying experience to know that you have people willing to sit in the rain to hear the rest of the story. So it was also a matter of logistics and budgeting. I mean, Shakespeare is public domain, which I know sounds a little slight, but it is true. But I mean, I do think there is a reason that his work is so popular, because it is incredibly deep. And they're also... You can do so much with it. You know, we're doing The Tempest this year, and I can guarantee you that it's unlike any production of The Tempest anyone has ever seen, which is what I'm really excited about. But then we're also doing an As You Like It that perhaps might be a little bit more traditional. So there's so much fluctuation, and all of the stories are very different. But I think there's just a psychology and an understanding of, like, the human condition that Shakespeare is able to tap into, and also just I've never been one for poetry, like, you know, but the way he uses language is just so exciting and beautiful if done right. And I do really pride our organization, because, you know, I know that some people have a stigma of Shakespeare and, you know, have traumatic flashbacks from high school English class, you know, having to, like, memorize Julius Caesar, or, like, try to make sense of all of this. But when you see it done right, it could be so exciting. And I'll never forget, I was able to catch a production of The Merchant of Venice with Al Pacino, and it blew me away.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, I didn't realize it could be this palpable and exciting, and that I could lean forward in my chair so much and appreciate this. And it's also interesting, because Shakespeare, when he wrote for people of all different socioeconomic placement, you know? So there's something very accessible about it, I think, when it's done right as well. You know, because you've got this beautiful romantic language, but you've also got very, very dark, sinister characters. You've got these amazing young romantic lovers, but then you've got these, like, dirty joke characters that sometimes you have to listen, and you're like, are they saying what I think they're saying? And it's like, yes, they're saying what you think they're saying. So I think there's just so much universality to it that makes it really rewarding. And every year that we do it, I kind of fall in love with the work more and more. And again, going back to my mentor, Jack O'Brien, I mean, he's sort of known as one of the prominent American directors of Shakespeare, and he's won multiple Tony Awards for his work on Broadway directing Shakespeare, amongst other things. And I think knowing how he is able to approach any production. For instance, he's working on The Sound of, he just mounted a production of The Sound of Music, which I've been fortunate enough to have been serving on as an assistant director. And, you know, the way he approached that text, he approached it the way I believe he would approach a Shakespearean text, with that much discipline and that much attention to the characters and what they're saying and what's happening. And it wasn't just, let's get through these book scenes so we can get to the musical numbers. And so I think there's a real attention and understanding to really nailing content when it comes to working with Shakespearean text. And I also think what's really exciting is that he wrote for communion, you know, so that the actors could see that the audience, and there was such a communion between player and audience member. So there's something sort of beautiful about that as well, that it isn't just this idea of the audience is in total darkness and, you know, these people are just speaking. It's like, no, these people are looking us in the eye and talking to us about, should, you know, to be or not to be. You know, that's, there's just something really beautiful and accessible about that.
Well, and that leads me to wonder, what are you trying to impart? What are you trying to accomplish by with your project, the Scranton Shakespeare Festival, in terms of community, in terms of expressing this art?
I guess a communion of community, and a nurturing ground for new talent as well as more experienced talent. As much as we will always have a foundation in Shakespearean text, I do think it's important that we're generating new works, because, you know, not only was Shakespeare a writer, but he was an actor, he was a director, and he was a producer. So a very good friend of mine, who is also a member of our company, was able to work with Trevor Nunn, who's one of the biggest Shakespearean directors as well. And she always quotes him as saying, Trevor would say, make it work. And I think that there's something very interesting about that. So I would like to believe that if, you know, he was around running a company, he would want new voices to be heard as well. So I think there's something important about us having new voices as well as a foundation in classical text. But I also think it's important that, you know, our programming is diverse enough that there's sort of something in it for everyone, you know? So the person who doesn't like musicals might really like this production, or the person who does like musicals but might be a little bit hesitant or leery of a play, you know, can kind of come and say, I had a really nice time, I'm going to come back next week and see what these crazy people are doing on the next show.
And you don't just
that's
have...
That's sort of what we're going for.
You don't just... Thank you for that. You don't just have Shakespeare, as you're alluding to, at the Scranton Shakespeare Festival. I know you have a musical called Footloose, for example.
Yes.
And that some people might ask, well, what does that have to do with Shakespeare, and how does that fit in? How would you respond to that?
Well, I can tell you we're approaching it like it's Shakespeare, which I know, you know, you're looking at it and you're thinking, oh, like the Kevin Bacon movie and the, you know, the like 80s song. But to me, it's about, and this whole season really is about, you know, a younger generation finding their voice. Whether it's the young executive coming into a big corporate business and rising from a window washer to the CEO of a company.
Oh, what production, you know, is that?
That's How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. But then you've got The Tempest, which is, you know, the young daughter whose father is basically runs the island. And then, you know, she's able to instill some new beliefs in him and stir up compassion, which is one of the most, like, moving phenomena. But, you know, and then in Footloose, it's a little more obvious. You've got a person who is, you know, fighting for what they believe is right, liberty. And it's also just an examination of what dance is, you know, as well as what religion is. And I think it's a story about grief. It's a story about a family who has been haunted by the loss of their dead son, and it's led to them, you know, repressing so much, as well as about a young person who can only sort of express themselves and their spirituality through movement, you know, and like, what is that transcendence and what is dance at the core of it? So there's like a lot of deeper themes that we're really trying to like bite into there. And, you know, I think there's a lot of that going on in this country. I think we've got a younger generation that's very much trying to find their voice right now, especially, you know, since the Parkland shootings. I think that's like something that's becoming very relevant, and I think that this play deals with that very much. But I think sort of all the plays of our season deal with that. So I understand where people might say, like, how is this Shakespearean? But I also think that I always find that musicals and Shakespeare are very similar. Because when you have a character singing a song, most likely they're singing the song to the audience. And they're singing the song because the dialogue, the plain text in the play is escalated to an emotional level that they turn right out and they start singing to you. So, you know, you have somebody singing, I can't stand still, or I've got to kick off my, you know, you've got this connection between person and audience, the same way that you have Hamlet turning out to the audience. And again, going back to be or not to be, do I do this or don't I do this? So I think there's a real sort of interesting parallel between musicals and Shakespeare. So I think it fits, you know, and the truth is that I could be doing every Shakespeare and someone's going to have something to say about it. And I get that, and it's in our name, and it's a very much part of our mission. And but, you know, I think it works. I guess the skeptics will have to come and check it out.
You are listening to Troubadours and Raconteurs with E.W. Conundrum Demure on Radio Free Brooklyn.
I agree with you. You sold me on it. I've been, and it does work. It does work. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to Michael Flynn, the founder, artistic director, and executive producer of the Scranton Shakespeare Festival, as well as one of the premier assistant directors working on Broadway today. It's a great honor to have you on the show. And I wanna now, you kind of already sort of put your big toe into this pool. I want to know what you think about political activism in art, especially given, you know, recently we had the Tony Awards and we had a lot of stuff going on that was political.
We did indeed. I think art's always been political. And I think I sort of have to wear two hats here. As an artistic director of a theater company in a community that has people of all different political views, I don't want anyone to feel isolated from a theater. So especially a show like Footloose, which deals very much with sort of conservative ideas and then more liberal ideas, I don't want to be condescending to either side or either perspective in that story and in that conflict. And as an artistic director, I want to make sure that, you know, people in their red hats feel comfortable going to see a show just like people who are wearing a rainbow flag. You know, I want everyone to feel welcome at a theater. I think that's very important. And I think that, you know, theater, I don't believe theater should be elitist. I don't think it should only be for one side and not the other. I think the beauty about what we as theater makers do is it's a group of people going into a room together and laughing at the same moment or crying at the same moment. And I think that there's something really great about that. And it's one of the few forms that can transcend some of these things. But, you know, of course people are going to have political opinions. That's the point of, you know, that's a very big part of theater. And some things are going to be more satirical and more politically charged than other pieces will be. But, you know, I think that everything is, you know, politics is the study of people. And drama is the dramatics of people. So, I mean, I think they go hand in hand. And I think that, you know, everyone has a voice and everyone should be able to use it. And if you don't want to listen to somebody, you know, I challenge you to listen to somebody, but you know, you can form your own opinions. And I get so frustrated when sometimes people think like, you know, I don't want to hear this actor or this singer say this or say that. It's like this person has devoted their life and worked very hard to get where they are. You know, and sometimes I don't agree with different celebrities' opinions on things, and I roll my eyes when I hear them say something. But you know, that's their platform, and we can't be upset because they've got something to say about it. And you know, if it starts getting incessant and you don't want to hear it, turn off your television. But you know, I think that especially this year, I don't think Robert De Niro is somebody who's been using every speech to make political comments, you know, nor Meryl Streep. You know, these people have won quite a few awards, and usually things don't get quite this heightened politically. I mean, since, you know, I mean, I'm sure there are a few, Jane Fonda, Marlon Brando, but for the most part, like, it comes in waves. But I think when you, you know, and here I'm going to say this, but when you have an administration that is actively trying to cut the arts and do away with the National Endowment of the Arts, do you think these people are not going to have anything to say? I mean, that's sort of where I come from at it. You know, it's hard to, I try very hard to be neutral because I'm very political as an individual, but as an artistic director, I try very hard to be neutral. But when you go after, you know, the National Endowment of the Arts, that then becomes, you know, you're taking people's livelihood away, and for what? So I've got quite a few comments on that, but I guess that's sort of my my opinion, my little opinion on that.
Well, and I think you would agree, too, that in society, in your country, you believe a burgeoning artistic set of options and energy is healthy for the country, for society, for people. And if you try to cut that out, it's damaging. It's damaging to our to our existence.
Yes, I would agree. I think that there's a lot of blame that can be spread pretty wide with all of this. I think technological advancement and social media is a big part of it. You know, we're not really engaging with each other as much as perhaps we used to. And I also think that there's a lot of economic inequality that's fueled some of this tension. But, you know, it is where it is, unfortunately, what it is. And I hope that, you know, I hope that some of this division can sort of be eradicated slightly. But, yeah, it's, you know, it's an exchange. It's a discourse of ideas. It's an exchange of ideas. And, you know, theater's always been doing that since the Greeks.
Excellent point. That's for sure. That's where I learned a lot of the early questions, eternal questions, and the multitude of answers to those questions was from, you know, Greek plays when I was a kid. Still reflecting on those. Yeah. So tell the folks who are listening, if you would, where they could find some information about the upcoming season at the Scranton Shakespeare Festival, and anything else you'd like to share with your work regarding your work in New York City.
You can check out our website at www.scrantonshakes.com, all one word. We're also on Facebook and Instagram under Scranton Shakes at on Instagram and the Scranton Shakespeare Festival on Facebook. And we are on Twitter and Snapchat as well. And you can find all the information about showtimes, locations, venues, mission statement, some photos and some fun quotes. New York has been great. I have to say that, you know, the first year or two, I had this feeling that I had to get back to New York when I was working here for the summers, thinking like, you know, I'm leaving the city too long, and if for my career I need to go there. But it sort of had a little bit of a Wizard of Oz effect in that, you know, every time I do, I am, you know, fortunate enough to work with people like Nathan Lane or Jack O'Brien, like Douglas Carter Bean. Everybody's always asking me, what's happening in Scranton? What are you doing in Scranton? So it's funny that it's sort of become my little, you know, a place for me to learn as a director as well. And I'm really grateful for that. We're doing another year, the Sound of Music National Tour, which I'm pretty excited. We just wrapped this first year of this specific tour. And it's going to go out again next year throughout North America, which is pretty exciting. That's sort of it right now.
Well, that's
and
a
it's
lot.
All about, you know, the next step. It is. And I'm very excited to be returning on that project.
Well, Michael Flynn, break a leg again and again and again. It is very inspiring, and very happy to know that you are doing so well in New York, and then you're bringing a lot of that energy here to our neck of the woods, our hometown. Scranton has always been artistically and culturally vibrant because of people such as yourself. You know, and I appreciate that so much. Thank you.
Yeah, there's a fun little lineage. And a little fun footnote is that when Footloose was on Broadway, it was directed by Scranton native Walter Bobby.
Wow.
So there's a fun little bit of history there.
That's fantastic. Oh, you can always connect things back to this area.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
You can.
Well, we'll see you out.
Yes, yes.
We'll see you out and about. I look forward to it. And again, thank you for taking some time out. I know you're just getting done with rehearsals tonight.
Thanks for listening to me.
Oh, it was a pleasure. See you soon.
Thank you very much, EW. Have a good night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Gypsy. There are no small parts, they say, and they're right, whoever they are. Given just a few lines, a skillful actor can make the smallest part memorable, revelatory, and integral to the production. Of course, a less skillful actor might strike a discordant note and be quickly and mercifully forgotten as the play moves on. I've had my share of small parts. Professor Willard in Our Town, Enoch Snow Jr. in Carousel, Yussel in Fiddler on the Roof. But one of my favorites was the Gypsy in a college production of Arthur Miller's Incident at Vichy. It's one of his lesser-known works. Originally produced in 1964, it's a talky but somehow swiftly moving play about a group of representative men rounded up by the Nazis in Vichy, France, in 1942. There are a businessman, an actor, a painter, an electrician, a doctor, a waiter, an Orthodox Jew, old Jew in the script, a nobleman, a young boy, and a gypsy. It soon becomes apparent why they were detained, and as they file one by one into an office for questioning, the play becomes a mystery. Who lacks proper papers, who is revealed to be a Jew and sent to his death, who is freed, who tries to escape, and a debate about individual morality, about society, and about history. It's an Arthur Miller play, so most of the characters get a say, and they're all conflicted and implicated. It's fairly weighty, as you can imagine, and there aren't many laughs. With the wrong cast and misguided direction, it can be a long, if thought-provoking, night at the theater. We had, I think, the right cast, and a spirited director who would stroke his long beard as he discussed with the actors how best to dramatize the debates. Frankie, always ready with the shtick, played the actor. Ronald, a funny fuss budget, played the high-strung businessman. Wally, a strange guy who fancied Star Trek shirts, played the old Jew. Perry, philosophical and literary, played the doctor. And Donnie, thin, fey, aristocratic, played the nobleman, an Austrian prince. I didn't have much to do as the gypsy. The character is more of an object of derision and suspicion than an active character. I did my best with my broken English lines. At one point, the director decided to give me some stage business, and he handed me a harmonica to play. My efforts sounded more tuneless cowboy than mournful Romany. At the college, before my turn as the gypsy, I played in a Roman comedy by Plautus, In a Toga, and Sebastian, one of the twins in Twelfth Night. Ronald, the businessman in Vichy, was a wonderfully over-the-top Malvolio. My academic training included an intro class with the venerated head of the theater department, a gentle, somewhat befuddled man in the waning days of his career who, in class, read to us in a feverish tone a play about a randy teen named Alice May. The classes were augmented now and then by informal sessions with older students who graduated or who left without graduating, including one raspy-voiced bohemian who was studying with a legendary acting teacher in New York City, and Donnie, who played the prince. Donnie was a talented actor who was something of a campus theatrical luminary. I'm not sure why he was still in town, as opposed to moving to New York to begin his career. But after we met, he became an unofficial mentor. Donnie would critique my performance, such as it was, as well as the performances of our fellow cast members. He would fill me in on gossip, new and old, the lifeblood of the theater. He would expand my theatrical education with his own very impressive knowledge. He was kind and concerned, if perhaps a bit too friendly, to his young acolyte. In addition to talking before and after rehearsal, we sometimes met at a coffee shop. Now and then he would show up at my dorm room, and if I wasn't around, my roommate, an intensely geeky pre-med major nicknamed Goofy, a moniker merited by his personality as well as his resemblance to the Disney character, would roll his eyes and tell me that the odd fellow stopped by again. Goofy and his equally intense and geeky pre-med pals didn't know what to make of the elegant Donnie and his quasi-bouffant hairdo. I basked in his attention while being more or less clueless about the nature of his affection, or at least one aspect of it. He was never overt, and whatever fondness he had for me never broached the mentor-apprentice relationship. He was a wistful guy, and he seemed resigned to disappointment even at his young age. The play's run ended, as they do, and the temporary family of cast and crew, so close for such a short time, disbanded, and we went on to the next play, or not. I left school in mid-semester and never saw Donnie again. My character, after being accused of stealing a pot in particular and of thievery in general, one of the many prejudices examined throughout the play, is taken away and presumably sent to his death, like most of the other characters in the play. The prince, after much self-probing and self-loathing, acts nobly and selflessly sacrifices himself for another. Here is my favorite line. Gypsy.
She swaps loneliness for happiness in the guise of a lover and friend. And who could comprehend the depth, the pain, the truth, or how vain? As the sun rises and sets, polar ice melts and alters our global axis rotation. She still hopes and holds dear the wisdom earned through her trials and tribulations.
Where have all the good men gone? And where are all the gods?
Yeah!
Where's the streetwise Hercules to fight the rising odds?
I'd like to know.
Isn't there a white knight upon a fiery steed? Late at night I toss and I turn.
I toss and I turn.
Dream of what I need. I need a hero.
And there you have it, episode 276 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, EW Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, this week's guest, Michael Flynn, theatrical impresario and artistic visionary. I also like to thank Uncle Cesare, a.k.a. Dr. Michael Pavese, our associate producer. And these musical artists: Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, The Doors, Beck, The How to Succeed Orchestra, Guns N' Roses, Jennifer Laura Thompson, Stacey Francis, Rosalind Brown, and Kathy Dietrich, as well as Terrence Blanchard and Branford Marsalis, too. Until next week, enjoy this one. Thanks for listening.